By late November 2022, Moscow, Idaho had become something no one ever expected it to be. A place where people were afraid to walk alone at night, where students were fleeing campus en masse, and where a quadruple murder investigation was consuming resources. From across the Pacific Northwest, it had been just over a week since four University of Idaho students were brutally murdered in their off-campus home, but it felt like a lifetime. The small college town that had prided itself on being one of the safest places in America was now the epicenter of one of the most complex murder investigations in recent memory. Previously on Brian Koberger, How We Got Here, four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death on November 13, 2022. The immediate aftermath saw hardware stores selling out of locks, students leaving campus early for Thanksgiving break, and investigators from multiple agencies descending on a small college town that had never seen anything like this level of violence. The community transformed overnight from a place where people didn't lock their doors to a place where everyone was looking over their shoulders. I'm Tony Bruschi, and this is our look back on how we got here in the case against Brian Koberger. And this is Episode 3, A Community in Fear. Today we're talking about how the investigation exploded in scope during late November 2022, how the FBI's involvement transformed the case into a national story, and how a routine police patrol in nearby Pullman would identify a crucial piece of evidence, though no one would know its significance for weeks. The turning point came on November 16th, 3 days after the murders, when Moscow Police Chief James Fry held a press conference that would change everything about how the public understood this case. The small press room at the Moscow Police Department was packed with reporters from local and national outlets, their cameras focused on a police chief who looked like he hadn't slept in days. Up until this point, information had been scarce and sometimes contradictory. The initial police statement that there was no ongoing community risk had been walked back just 3 days later when Chief Fry admitted, "We cannot say that there is no threat to the community." Rumors were spreading faster than facts, filling the information vacuum with speculation and fear. The community was demanding answers, and Chief Fry was about to provide the most detailed timeline yet of what investigators knew about the victim's final hours. But this press conference would do more than just provide information. It would mark the moment when the Moscow Police Department acknowledged that this case was beyond their capabilities and resources. It was the moment when a local tragedy became a national story. According to the official timeline released during that press conference, the sequence of events began on Saturday night, November 12th. Kaylee Gonsalves and Madison Mogan went to the Corner Club, a downtown Moscow bar popular with university students. The Corner Club sits on Main Street in the heart of downtown Moscow, a strip of bars and restaurants that serves as the social center for University of Idaho students. On any given weekend night, the Corner Club would be packed with students celebrating the end of another week, socializing with friends, and enjoying the kind of carefree college experience that Moscow had always been known for. According to witnesses who spoke to investigators, November 12th seemed like any other Saturday night. The bar was busy, the atmosphere was normal, and Gonsalves and Mogan appeared to be having a good time with friends. Meanwhile, across town, Ethan Chapin and Zana Kernodle attended a party at the Sigma Chi Fraternity House. The Sigma Chi House, like most fraternity houses near the University of Idaho campus, regularly hosted parties on weekend nights. These gatherings were typically loud, crowded affairs where students from across campus came to socialize and unwind. According to witness statements provided to investigators, the Sigma Chi party on November 12th was typical for a weekend night. There was music, drinking, and the kind of social interaction that characterizes college party culture. Chapin, who was a member of Sigma Chi, was well known at the house and among his fraternity brothers. Kernodle, his girlfriend, was a regular presence at fraternity events. Nothing about either location, the Corner Club or the Sigma Chi house, suggested anything unusual was happening that night. No one reported seeing anything suspicious. No one noticed anyone paying unusual attention to any of the four victims. And no one had any indication that this would be anything other than a normal Saturday night in a college town. The timeline revealed that both pairs returned to 1122 King Road at approximately 1:45 a.m. on November 13th. But before going home, Gonsalves and Mogan had made a stop that would prove crucial to the investigation. They were captured on surveillance footage at a food truck downtown around 1:40 a.m. This wasn't just any surveillance footage. The grub truck, as it was known locally, operated late hours specifically to serve students leaving bars and parties. The food truck had become something of an institution in Moscow, a gathering place for hungry students looking for a late-night meal before heading home. The owner of the grub truck, who spoke to local media in the days following the murders, described Gonsalves and Mogan as regular customers who were always friendly and polite. On the night of November 12th, they ordered their usual food and chatted briefly with the operators before heading home. But for investigators, this footage represented much more than a simple food purchase. It provided a precise timestamp of when the victims were last seen alive in public. It showed their demeanor and behavior. They appeared happy, relaxed, and completely unaware of any danger. Most importantly, it captured not just the victims, but everyone else who was in the area at the same time. The footage showed Gonsalves and Mogan ordering food and interacting normally with other customers and the food truck operators. They were laughing, talking with friends, and behaving like typical college students who had been drinking, but weren't impaired to the point of concern. There was no indication of fear, no signs that they felt threatened or believed they were being followed. But investigators were analyzing this footage frame by frame, looking for more than just the victim's behavior. They were documenting every face, every vehicle, every person who appeared in the background of what would become crucial evidence. They were looking for anyone else in the area who might have been paying unusual attention to the two women. The grub truck surveillance footage would eventually be watched hundreds of times by investigators, analyzed by FBI behavioral specialists, and enhanced using advanced video processing techniques. Every person who appeared in the footage would be identified and interviewed. Every vehicle that drove past would be traced and investigated. The timeline also revealed new details about the house itself and what happened after everyone returned home. According to the police statement, the four victims were in the house along with two other roommates who lived on the first floor. The layout of this three-story house would prove crucial to understanding how four people could be murdered while two others remained unharmed. 1122 King Road was typical of student housing in Moscow, a large house that had been converted to accommodate multiple tenants. The first floor housed Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funke. The second floor contained the main living areas, kitchen, living room, and Zana Kernodle's bedroom. The third floor had bedrooms for Kaylee Gonsalves and Madison Mogan. This layout meant that sounds from the upper floors might not always be clearly heard on the first floor, depending on what was happening and how the sound traveled through the house. It also meant that someone entering through the sliding glass door on the second floor would have access to the second and third floors without necessarily alerting anyone on the first floor. The house sat in a neighborhood that was popular with University of Idaho students, close enough to campus to walk or bike, but far enough away to feel like you're living off campus rather than in a dorm. King Road itself was a quiet residential street where neighbors knew each other and crime was virtually non-existent. According to neighbors who spoke to investigators, 1122 King Road was known as a house where college students lived, but it wasn't a problem property. There were no noise complaints, no reports of wild parties, no issues that would have drawn police attention. The residents were described as typical college students who kept to themselves and didn't cause any trouble. But the house's location and layout would prove significant in ways that no one could have anticipated. Its position on King Road provided multiple approach routes for someone who might have been surveilling the property. The sliding glass door on the second floor offered an entry point that wouldn't be visible from the street, and the internal layout allowed someone to move between floors without necessarily being detected by everyone in the house. Chief Fry's press conference also revealed something that shocked even experienced investigators. There were no signs of forced entry. This detail immediately raised questions about how the killer had gained access. Either the doors were unlocked, as not uncommon, In a college town where many students didn't bother with locks, or the killer had found another way in, or someone had let him in. The lack of forced entry suggested several possibilities, each with different implications for the investigation. The killer might have been familiar with the house layout. He might have been watching the house and knew the habits of the residents. He might have known about the sliding glass door and how to access it without being seen. Or he might have simply gotten lucky with an unlocked door. In a place like Moscow, unlocked doors weren't unusual. Many residents, especially students, operated under the assumption that their community was safe. It wasn't uncommon for people to leave their cars unlocked, their bikes unsecured, their apartments open. The idea that you needed multiple locks and security systems would have seemed paranoid just days earlier. But the lack of forced entry also raised darker possibilities. Had the killer been watching the house long enough to understand the routines of the residents? Did he know when people were home and when they weren't? Had he planned this attack carefully, or was it a crime of opportunity? These questions would haunt investigators as they tried to understand not just what happened, but how and why. The absence of forced entry meant that the killer had either been very lucky or very prepared. Neither possibility was comforting to a community that was trying to understand how something like this could happen in their quiet college town. But the November 16th press conference did more than just provide timeline details. It marked the moment when this case officially became a federal investigation. Chief Fry announced that the FBI was now fully involved, bringing resources and expertise that the small Moscow Police Department simply didn't possess. To understand the significance of this moment, you have to understand what the Moscow Police Department typically dealt with. According to FBI statistics, Moscow typically investigates 0 to 2 homicides per year, usually domestic disputes or drug-related incidents that are solved quickly. The agency had 16 full-time officers responsible for a city of about 25,000 people. They handled traffic stops, noise complaints, minor thefts, and the occasional domestic disturbance. The most serious crimes they usually investigated were burglaries or assaults, cases that might require a few days or weeks of investigation. They had never handled a quadruple homicide. They had never dealt with national media attention. They had never managed an investigation that would require months of work and involve thousands of pieces of evidence. Chief Fry was honest about his department's limitations. In his press conference, he acknowledged that they needed help from agencies with more experience and resources. This wasn't an admission of failure, it was a recognition of reality. No small-town police department is equipped to handle a case of this magnitude. The FBI's involvement meant several things. First, it brought specialized personnel, behavioral analysts who could help develop a profile of the killer, digital forensics specialists who could analyze the massive amount of electronic evidence, and administrative support to help manage what was quickly becoming an enormous investigation. The behavioral analysts were particularly important. These are FBI agents trained to understand criminal psychology, to identify patterns in violent behavior, and to develop profiles that can help investigators understand what kind of person they're looking for in a case with no obvious motive and no immediate suspects. Understanding the psychology of the killer could provide crucial insights. Second, the FBI brought advanced technology and laboratory resources. The FBI's labs could process DNA evidence faster and more accurately than state facilities. Their digital forensics capabilities could analyze phone records, social media data, and surveillance footage more efficiently than local departments. Their database access was unparalleled. Third, and perhaps most importantly, it brought the National DNA Database, CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System. CODIS contains genetic profiles from convicted offenders, arrestees in some states, and unsolved crime scenes from across the country. If the killer's DNA was in the system because of previous arrests or convictions, the FBI could potentially identify him quickly. The FBI also established the tip line that would become both a blessing and a burden for investigators. According to official statements, the tip line would eventually receive more than 2,600 emails and 2,700 phone calls from people who thought they had information relevant to the case. But managing This volume of tips required a systematic approach that the FBI had developed through decades of experience with high-profile cases. They established a command center where specially trained agents would review every tip that came in. Each tip was assigned a priority level based on its specificity and potential relevance to the case. The FBI developed a triage system based on specificity, timing, and corroboration with known facts. Tips that provided specific information aligning with the timeline and known evidence got immediate attention. For example, if someone called to report seeing a specific type of vehicle near the house around the time of the murders, that tip would be prioritized for immediate follow-up. Mid-priority tips might include reports of suspicious behavior or unusual activities in the days or weeks leading up to the murders. These required investigation but weren't considered as immediately urgent as tips that directly related to the night of the murders. Low-priority tips included vague reports of suspicious activity, conspiracy theories, and tips that couldn't be corroborated with known facts. These were still logged and reviewed, but they didn't receive immediate investigative attention unless additional information made them more credible. Every single tip had to be evaluated, no matter how unlikely it seemed. The FBI has learned from previous cases that sometimes the most important information comes from unexpected sources. Someone calling to report that their neighbor had been acting strangely might be providing crucial information, or they might be settling a personal grudge. Someone reporting a suspicious vehicle might have seen the killer's car, or they might have seen a delivery driver. The challenge was that most tips in cases like this are well-intentioned but ultimately unhelpful. People report delivery drivers as suspicious persons, normal late-night activities as threatening behavior, and develop elaborate theories based on incomplete information they've seen in media coverage. But buried among thousands of unhelpful tips might be the one piece of information that breaks the case open. Investigators couldn't afford to ignore any of them. This meant assigning personnel to follow up on every credible lead, no matter how unlikely it seemed. Meanwhile, the scope of the physical investigation was expanding dramatically. According to official statements, investigators executed more than 50 search warrants in the weeks following the murders. These warrants allowed them to search homes, vehicles, electronic devices, and financial records belonging to anyone who might have information relevant to the case. Each search warrant required probable cause and judicial approval. Investigators had to present evidence to judges explaining why they believed specific searches would yield information relevant to the murders. This process takes time and requires careful documentation, but it's essential for ensuring that evidence collected will be admissible in court. The search warrants covered a wide range of targets. Some were for the homes and vehicles of people who had been in contact with the victims in the days before the murders. Others were for businesses near the crime scene that might have surveillance footage. Still others were for digital evidence, phone records, social media accounts, and internet activity. Each warrant had to be executed carefully and thoroughly. When investigators searched a home, they had to document everything they found, photograph every room, and catalog every piece of potential evidence. When they seized electronic devices, they had to ensure the chain of custody was maintained so that any evidence found would be admissible in court. The volume of evidence collected was staggering. Investigators were dealing with physical evidence from the crime scene, digital evidence from phones and computers, surveillance footage from dozens of cameras around Moscow, and witness statements from hundreds of people who had interacted with the victims in their final days. The crime scene itself required extraordinary attention. According to court documents, investigators collected 113 pieces of physical evidence and took more than 4,000 photographs. Every angle of every room, every potential piece of evidence, every blood stain and fingerprint had to be documented. To put this in perspective, a typical homicide scene might require 50 to 100 photographs and yield 20 to 30 pieces of evidence. The Idaho murders crime scene required 40 times as many photographs and nearly 6 times as much physical evidence. This wasn't just because 4 people had been killed, it was because investigators couldn't be sure what might be relevant to solving the case. Every fiber found on the victim's clothing had to be analyzed. Every fingerprint found in the house had to be identified and compared to databases. Every drop of blood had to be tested for DNA. Every hair found at the scene had to be examined under a microscope. This level of documentation isn't just for the current investigation. These photos and evidence would need to support prosecution efforts that might not go to trial for years. Defense attorneys would scrutinize every detail, looking for any mistakes or oversights that could create reasonable doubt. Investigators had to ensure their documentation was thorough and unassailable. The 4,000-plus photographs also illustrate the brutal nature of what happened in that house. Four people were stabbed to death with what investigators described as a large fixed-blade knife. According to the coroner's report, each victim suffered multiple stab wounds. At least one victim had defensive wounds indicating they had fought back against their attacker. The weapon was never recovered despite extensive searches of the area around the house. Investigators used metal detectors to search yards, parks, and wooded areas. They searched dumpsters, storm drains, and any location where a knife might have been discarded. The fact that the weapon was never found suggested that the killer took it with him when he left. This detail troubled investigators because it indicated a level of planning and presence of mind that ruled out a completely spontaneous attack. Someone who commits a crime of passion might leave the weapon at the scene. Someone who plans an attack and has the presence of mind to take the weapon with them is a different kind of killer entirely. The brutality of the attacks also provided insights into the killer's psychology. According to the autopsy reports, the victim suffered what forensic pathologists described as overkill, far more injuries than would have been necessary to cause death. This suggested intense rage, personal motivation, or sadistic tendencies. But the most promising piece of physical evidence remained the tan leather knife sheath found on the bed next to Madison Mogan's body. This K-bar-style sheath had been left behind when the killer took the knife, and it would prove to contain microscopic traces of DNA that would eventually solve the case. Digital evidence presented its own challenges. Investigators had to analyze phone records, social media accounts, app usage data, and location information for all four victims. But they also had to identify and investigate anyone who had recent contact with the victims, which meant analyzing similar data for dozens of other people. The volume of digital evidence in modern murder cases is staggering. Every text message, every social media post, every app notification, every GPS ping creates a digital record. In the case of four college students, this meant thousands of digital interactions in the days and weeks leading up to their deaths. Investigators had to reconstruct the victims' digital lives. They analyzed Instagram posts to understand their social connections. They reviewed Snapchat messages to identify recent conversations. They examined TikTok activity to understand their interests and behaviors. They traced Venmo transactions to understand their recent activities. Each victim's phone contained thousands of photos, messages, and app interactions. Investigators had to review all of this information, looking for anything that might be relevant: threats, concerning interactions, new relationships, or changes in behavior that might provide clues about why they were targeted. But the digital evidence would eventually prove crucial in ways that no one anticipated. In November 2022, modern smartphones create detailed records of where we go, when we're there, and what we do. These digital breadcrumbs would eventually reveal patterns of behavior that would point directly to a suspect. Cell phone tower data, in particular, would prove to be a gold mine of information. Every time a phone connects to a cell tower, it creates a record of when and where that connection occurred. By analyzing tower data, investigators could potentially track the movements of anyone who was in the area around the time of the murders. This type of analysis requires sophisticated software and expertise that the Moscow Police Department didn't possess. But the FBI has specialized units trained in digital forensics who could process this information and identify patterns that might be invisible to traditional investigators. As the investigation expanded, so did the media attention. Major news networks that had initially sent single reporters were now establishing semi-permanent bureaus in Moscow. CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and other national outlets brought satellite trucks, multiple camera crews, and teams of reporters. The transformation of Moscow from a quiet college town to the center of a national media circus was jarring for residents. Suddenly, their local coffee shops were filled with reporters. Their quiet neighborhoods were disrupted by satellite trucks and camera crews. Their daily routines were interrupted by journalists seeking interviews and information. Local news stations that normally covered city council meetings and high school football games suddenly found themselves at the center of a national story. KLEW-TV, the local NBC affiliate, went from being a small-town news operation to providing live updates to national networks. The Moscow Pullman Daily News, a small local newspaper, was suddenly fielding calls from journalists around the world. The demand for new information was constant, creating pressure on investigators who couldn't share details about their methods or findings without potentially compromising their case. Every day, reporters would ask for updates. Every day, investigators would have to balance the public's demand for information with the need to protect their investigation. This created an ongoing tension between the public's demand for information and the investigators' need to protect their case. Press conferences became exercises in saying as little as possible while appearing to be transparent. Chief Fry and other officials had to balance keeping the community informed with avoiding the release of information that might help the killer evade capture. The media attention also created pressure on the families of the victims. Suddenly, they were dealing not just with unimaginable grief, but with reporters seeking interviews and information. Some family members, like Steve Gonsalves, chose to speak publicly about their loss and their frustrations with the investigation. Others maintained their privacy and declined to speak to media. The constant media presence also affected the investigation itself. Investigators had to be careful about when and where they conducted interviews or searches. They couldn't risk having sensitive investigative activities captured by news cameras or reported before they were complete. Social media complicated things even further. Facebook groups dedicated to discussing the case sprouted up immediately, attracting thousands of members who shared theories, analyzed available information, and sometimes spread misinformation. Reddit communities dissected every piece of available evidence and developed elaborate theories about potential suspects. Some of this amateur investigation was helpful. Internet sleuths sometimes identify inconsistencies or connections that professional investigators miss. But much of it was counterproductive, spreading false information and creating additional noise that investigators had to sort through. Worse, some amateur investigators began harassing people they had identified as potential suspects based on incomplete information. Innocent people found their personal information shared online and their lives disrupted by accusations from strangers on the internet. Law enforcement had to issue repeated warnings asking the public not to take investigative matters into their own hands. But in the age of social media, controlling the flow of information and preventing vigilante behavior is nearly impossible. The community impact during this period cannot be overstated. According to university enrollment data, approximately 25 to 40% of students had left early for Thanksgiving break, and many were not planning to return for the spring semester. Parents across the country were calling their children at the University of Idaho, demanding they come home immediately. Some students wanted to stay and finish the semester, but their families weren't taking no for an answer. The exodus was so significant that local businesses reported dramatic drops in revenue. The economic impact rippled through the entire community. Restaurants that normally thrived on student customers saw their revenue plummet. The bars downtown, which had been packed the weekend of the murders, were nearly empty in the following weeks. Property managers reported unusual numbers of lease terminations as students broke their housing contracts to leave Moscow. But the psychological impact went beyond just the university community. Moscow residents who had lived there for decades were suddenly questioning their safety. Neighborhood watch groups formed spontaneously. People who had never given much thought to home security were installing motion sensor lights and doorbell cameras. According to reports from the Moscow Police Department, Calls to 911 increased dramatically in the weeks following the murders. Most of these calls were reports of suspicious activity that turned out to be nothing. Delivery drivers, neighbors taking walks, normal activities that suddenly seemed threatening in the new context of fear. The university tried to maintain some semblance of normal operations, but everything had changed. The November 30th Memorial Vigil at the Kibbe Dome brought together thousands of grieving students, faculty, and community members. The families of all four victims attended, with Steve Gonsalves making a statement that would haunt everyone present. According to news reports from the vigil, Gonsalves confirmed that his daughter Kaylee and her best friend Madison Mogan had died together in the same room, in the same bed. This detail, shared publicly for the first time, emphasized the close friendship between the two women and the tragic circumstances of their deaths. The vigil was meant to provide closure and comfort to the community, but it also highlighted how far they were from any resolution. Four students were dead, their killer was still at large, and despite the massive investigation, there were no arrests and no clear suspects. Behind the scenes, however, something significant was happening that wouldn't become public knowledge for weeks. On November 29th, 16 days after the murders, a Washington State University police officer was conducting routine patrols when he spotted a white Hyundai Elantra on campus. The officer documented the vehicle and its license plate as part of standard patrol procedures. At the time, this seemed like routine police work. WSU is just 8 miles from the University of Idaho, and it's common for students from both schools to visit each other's campuses. But this white Hyundai Elantra would prove to be one of the most important pieces of evidence in the entire investigation. The car belonged to Brian Koberger, a 28-year-old criminology PhD student at Washington State University. At the time of that November 29th patrol, Koberger was going about his normal life, attending classes, teaching students, and maintaining the appearance of a typical graduate student. What investigators didn't know yet was that they had been looking for this exact vehicle. Digital evidence and surveillance footage would eventually reveal that a white Hyundai Elantra had been in the area around the time of the murders. But connecting that vehicle to a specific person would require weeks of additional investigation. And then the November 29th identification of Koberger's car was a breakthrough that investigators wouldn't recognize for some time. They had found their suspect, but they didn't know it yet. Koberger continued his normal routine, unaware that his vehicle had been flagged and that investigators were about to begin the process that would eventually lead to his arrest. As November ended and December began, the investigation was about to enter a new phase. The DNA analysis of the knife sheath was nearing completion. Digital forensic specialists were beginning to identify patterns in cell phone tower data that would prove crucial. And somewhere in the massive pile of tips and leads was information that would eventually point directly to the killer. The community of Moscow was learning to live with fear and uncertainty. Students were making difficult decisions about whether to return for spring semester. Families were grieving while demanding justice. And investigators were working around the clock, processing evidence and following leads, knowing that somewhere in all the data they were analyzing was the key to solving the case. But they also knew they were running out of time. Every day that passed without an arrest was another day that the killer remained free. Every day was another day that the community lived in fear. Every day was another day that four families waited for answers about who had taken their children from them and why. The breakthrough was coming, but it would require advanced forensic techniques, innovative investigative methods, and a level of digital detective work that had never been attempted in Idaho. The microscopic traces of DNA on a leather knife sheath were about to reveal their secrets. Cell phone tower data was about to tell a story of surveillance and premeditation. And a white Hyundai Elantra was about to become the most sought-after vehicle in America. Next time on Brian Koberger, How We Got Here. The search for a white Hyundai Elantra that would captivate the nation. The advanced genetic genealogy work that would identify a suspect. And the December developments that would finally give investigators the break they needed to bring a killer to justice.